The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
We are going to start with Venezuela, and we were trying to decide what is the appropriate scope and scale to put on this and how to describe it in a world where all sorts of different sides are claiming this is different things. So we decided to open with the US president's description of it. And that is the music that Donald Trump put on a video of missile strikes in Venezuela yesterday. It's Fortunate Son. It's the Creedence Clearwater Revival. And that song was actually written about the Vietnam War and specifically draft dodging by the rich in the Vietnam War, such as, one Donald Trump did himself, making up an injury in order to avoid the draft. And it probably summed up the tone that the US side tried to put on this, that this was some sort of action movie, essentially. Pete Hegseth with the remarkable quote that Nicolas Maduro effed around and found out, and everything basically trying to be some sort of an American war movie, as they were putting it. Joining me to begin our newspaper panel, because this story is all about the newspapers today, Breida Brown of Unique Media, Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner and founder and former director of One in Four, and Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central. You're all very welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Still keep saying that. And of course, across the front pages, as I mentioned, this story is everywhere. US to run Venezuela after troops grab Maduro in shock raid, says the Sunday Independent. The Sunday Times has a full-length photo, or near full-length photo, of Maduro from the US Iwo Jima, where he's there in that sort of fleecy Nike tracksuit. He was apparently captured in his pajamas with the headphones on, with the goggles, handcuffs around him, and the bottle of water in his hand. And the headline is, "We'll run Venezuela," vows the US after capture of Maduro. That image also on the front page of the Mail on Sunday. "America on the warpath" is the subhead. "Trump, I now run Venezuela." And Colin, we might start with you just to try and put a tone on this, because on one hand, I imagine there are a lot of Venezuelans who are waking up today who won't be crying into their cornflakes that Maduro was gone, that he wasn't the legitimate winner of their last election. On the other hand, the way it has been done and the question over how the US is now going to handle the running of Venezuela and its democratic future is very up in the air. What do you make of it all?
Well, I think, and the why it was done in the first place, obviously, is the one thing that people also need to think about, because why this particular regime and why this particular intervention? You're right. I mean, Maduro won't be missed by very many people at all. He was a horrendously corrupt authoritarian. He was responsible for thousands of arbitrary arrests and detentions. Extrajudicial executions were the norm in Venezuela under his control. 7 million people have left the country. The economy is collapsing, inflation running at over 70% and hundreds of percents at various points. The country was in an absolute state. There's no doubt about that. And yes, his legitimacy as a leader, I mean, he clearly didn't win the last couple of elections there. There was enormous election fraud. There haven't been free and fair elections in Venezuela at any stage across the period that he's been in power. All of that said, international law exists for a reason. And it's interesting to read how many people, including our own Minister for Foreign Affairs and our own Taoiseach, have talked about the importance of international law being upheld and international law being respected. This intervention by the US is a flagrant breach of international law. It's likely not even legal under US law. Under US law, for instance, the UN Charter is enforceable. So there are legal obligations on the US president when it comes to the UN Charter. The UN Charter is really, really clear that military intervention in another country is not permitted unless it's for reasons of self-defense or upon the invitation of the government of that jurisdiction. So this was an illegal intervention in Venezuela. There's no doubt about that. But you're right. I mean, he won't be missed, I wouldn't imagine, by most Venezuelans.
No, and they didn't really, in the press conference yesterday, provide any massive defense for that legality question. It was said, obviously, we couldn't tell Congress leaks, but that was about the sum total of, you know, their defense. Nothing mentioned about international law.
Yeah, I mean, they're likely to say that this was exactly what was used as a defense for previous interventions in Latin America by previous US administrations. They're likely to say that the military there to support law enforcement, that because Maduro had been indicted for trial in in the United States in order to secure his arrest, detention and transfer to the United States for prosecution. The military were there to support the support law enforcement, and that's the reason why they'll seek to legitimize that intervention. That the legal rationale behind that was developed to rationalize, I think, the arrest of Noriego in Panama a number of years ago. The guy who wrote it was a man called William Barr, who went on to become Donald Trump's first attorney general. It's a very contested legal opinion. It doesn't seem to have much veracity to it. I think it'll be highly contested. But let's be clear, Donald Trump doesn't really care very much about the rule of law, whether it be international or domestic. I mean, he has no regard for the rule of law. That's the thing, by the way, that I think we should be all deeply concerned about. The international order is breaking down in ways that would have been unimaginable even a decade ago, probably even 5 years ago, probably even under the first Trump administration. Law and the rule of law has no meaning anymore. We're getting to a point where it is now the norm for strongmen leaders and for leaders of authoritarian leaders of big countries to simply go and seize territory, do whatever they want to do. I mean, look at what's happening in Ukraine. Look at the US response to that at the moment. Look now at what the US is doing in Venezuela. He's already threatening now to extend that into Colombia if Colombia doesn't behave itself. Like, where's coming next? The rationale that they've presented about this, of course, that, you know, they say that Maduro wasn't head of government or wasn't a president. He was the head of a drug cartel. And he's been indicted on drug running charges at exactly the same time, or within about a month of Trump pardoning a former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who received a 45-year sentence for drug running in the US. And Trump pardoned him just recently. Clearly, Trump doesn't mind right-wing conservative drug-running presidents, but he has a problem with leftist ones.
Yeah, drug runners are fine as long as they agree with you.
Or as long as they don't have the world's largest reserve of oil.
Well, which is what this is it. And like, Gary, this was the read that I got out of the press conference yesterday, was that the bottom of it, when he said that the multinationals are going to come in and they'll spend billions and they will take much greater billions out of Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, that press conference yesterday was one of the most extraordinary things I've witnessed in however many years in politics. I mean, but also was probably the most truthful Donald Trump has ever been too. I mean, when asked who's going to run Venezuela, he said, "We are." In a sentence or two later, he said, "Our oil company's going to go in. They're going to fix the infrastructure. They're going to look after the Venezuelan people, but we're going to take billions out of it." I mean, it's probably the most truthful Donald Trump has been. However, it is horrific. Any pretense that we have lived in a rules-based system has been obliterated. The American state under Donald Trump don't care about any of the type of nuances that we've just heard so eloquently from Colm. That's all gone now. We live in an age where might is right, where if the US wants something, they will take it. If Russia wants something, they are now looking at taking it. If China now go into Taiwan, they will possibly take it and nobody's going to do anything. This is a grim, grisly age we've gone into. I think we need to be very concerned about Greenland. I think it's been proven now that when Donald Trump and his administration and whoever kind of being backing them and pushing them, when they say something, they should be taken seriously. I think Greenland, we should be very concerned. I think Cuba, what he said about Cuba yesterday also. I think the fact that I remember Donald Trump was less than a year ago when he talked about the fact that Zelensky hadn't held any presidential elections because they're living under war. He said, "Oh, that's really interesting." You can see now coming into the midterm elections in the US, the fact that they will now say that there's some conflict going on. If American body bags start coming back from Venezuela, you can see all sorts of pretenses being used to justify things that 5 years ago we never thought imaginable.
And it might seem sensational for Gary to, and I agree with Gary, by the way, that we should be concerned about Greenland. It might seem sensational to suggest that Greenland could become a target, given that Denmark is a NATO member. Mm-hmm. But I think the future of NATO is very much in doubt. And I think if Donald Trump needed to set NATO aside in order to be able to go ahead and seize Greenland, he would absolutely do that. And actually, my big worry right now is Taiwan. I think a Chinese intervention in Taiwan is looking more likely by the week at the moment, because
there's an interesting piece in the Irish Daily Mail as well this morning, or the Mail on Sunday, by Mark Almond, who's the director of the Crisis Research Institute in Oxford. And he said, "We could be forgiven for wondering what happened to Donald J. Trump, the prospective Nobel Peace Prize winner, which is quite interesting.
Well, that FIFA Peace Prize looks a little less shiny, doesn't it?
It's undermined completely.
Yeah, terribly undermined. Very serious and august award, of course.
Doesn't it? But I mean, he goes on as well to say that while a lot of people are talking about this as being sort of a complete surprise, he said it's actually been months in the making. And he said little was made of the US carrier USS Gerald R. Ford moving into the Caribbean in October. But now it's become apparent that the strikes that did on drug smuggling boats and the seizure of two oil tankers were actually just preludes to the main show. So this has all been really actually quite, unlike Donald Trump, quite strategically planned, which is quite unusual for him. And this piece goes on as well to say that he, you know, Trump has been talking as well quite a lot over the past while about the Monroe Doctrine, which is going back to the previous president of the US, President Monroe, in the late 1800s. And basically the right of the US and no other world power to decide what goes on in the Americas. And that's actually what's happening now.
And indeed called it the Donroe Doctrine yesterday, saying that it was going to bring it into a new world.
Of course, he'd name it after himself.
Natural
I mean, the planning piece is a really important point. You're quite right. This has been long in the plan. Mm. New York Times have some fantastic coverage of this. I was listening to it earlier on. They were saying that actually there was a CIA team that went in to Venezuela in August, and that they were very closely monitoring Maduro's movements. They had every single part of his life documented in detail, right down to what kind of pets he had, what kind of pet food they had, where they got it from. They were able to track his movement and predict his movements on a day-by-day basis because they had agents on the ground, CIA agents on the ground from August on, a team on the ground doing that across all of that period. And actually, they held off. The operation could have taken place any time from Christmas Day onwards, but they were holding it off in part because of the weather, but also because they needed him to be in the compound that they had rehearsed his seizure from. So they were waiting for him for the weather to be right, but also for him to be in the particular compound that they had been rehearsing or practicing. They built a full size replica of that compound in Kentucky. I mean, they got into the compound and seized him within minutes.
Mm. And he said, I know it was so dramatic. I think you're right, in that press conference was extraordinary, but in the way that it described everything, that he got to the door of this other safe room, big massive doors, and had almost closed it, and then they nabbed him.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy was similar to, I think we all seen Zero Dark Thirty, where they film about the capture of Osama bin Laden. I mean, that whole pretense of like building compounds, I mean, that's something the Americans will do. I don't think anybody expected. So there had been a build-up of ships around the Americas, but I don't think anyone expected them to go in and actually capture Maduro. I think the expectation was that he would concede, that he would step down. But the idea of American forces going in, capture Maduro, nobody laments the loss of Maduro. But that was beyond what anybody could have expected.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody was expecting some form of attacks, some form of strikes. There had been strikes in the day previously, but the fact that American forces went in, were able to extract them, I mean, that requires on the ground, like a lot of obviously the CIA on the ground, but that would require a lot more engagement with people on the ground in Venezuela. Well,
they had actually in the weeks before this, and all of those attacks reportedly now were to ramp up pressure to encourage Maduro to leave. It had been put to him that he should go into exile in Turkey. A whole deal had been worked out, and he rejected it at the last moment.
Mm.
And that's then when they sanctioned this. Maduro had been on television in Venezuela. He does this thing where he a little bit like Trump, frankly, but probably not to YMCA. He does this ridiculous dance. I think it was meant to be a symbol of defiance to show that he thought the US were just bluffing, and they weren't really going to do it, and they weren't.
Yeah, and it does bring us into that situation where you can no longer assume that Donald Trump is bluffing with many of the outrageous things that he does say. Some of the texts that we've had in here: America is now run by the oil companies and corporations. If there was ever democracy in America, it's now dead. Another text are saying Trump and his lackeys are a threat to our world. He's there for the oil and what he can get. But where is international law? No one will stand up to Trump. The press conference was absolutely outrageous. And this one, I suppose, Gary, is one that you're going to be asked and politicians here are going to be asked. Could you ask the panel, should the EU now move closer towards military integration, i.e. an EU army, if this is the America that we are sharing the world with?
Yeah, I mean, from the perspective of Ireland, there is no money that we can spend that would make you safe in a war in that regard. I mean, what we should do is what we're really good at, which is actually diplomacy. Diplomacy is on its knees at the moment. International law is on its knees. But where's the Irish position is absolutely people who should be standing for peace when it is difficult. And I know that sounds farcical at a time where we've just seen what America done yesterday, where I'm talking about the fact that Greenland is on the threat. But I mean, the European Union you seen yesterday in terms of how limited it was in its criticisms, talking about international law when it's been decimated. But I think in the world where things are getting darker, I think the Irish position can't just be to bark behind the big dogs. I think we have to do what we've done well, which is stand for diplomacy, stands for rules-based order when it is difficult. And that is going to be a position that becomes harder to justify, but it's the only position that for us will keep us in any way safe, we feel.
And accepting that if the US or if Russia or any other big state actually wanted to do something, they'd be well able to.
Going back to the Greeks against the Minoans, when the strong will do what they will and the weak suffer what we must. So we also need to do what we're really good at, which is actually standing for peace and never stepping away from that, even when it's difficult.
Mm. Breda, how do you think, and we were talking about it yesterday, how this is going to play? Because Donald Trump had said, he was talking about not being involved in any wars. America first, they were going to retreat from the world. And he was asked at that press conference, how is this America first? How do you think this plays domestically for him with the MAGA movement? If, as Gary said, because they have a very small footprint in Venezuela, the body bags start coming back and heading towards those midterm elections.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be basically this, what I think has made me realise is that this was organised, right? So he knew, I think we focus on Donald Trump quite a lot, where it's a case that people sort of think everything is quite sporadic and that he doesn't plan. This was absolutely organised. And the really interesting piece for me today was in the Sunday Times, where they, you know, if anybody who was sort of waking up this morning and wasn't really sure what's going on, the piece in the Sunday Times on the front page and a double page spread inside gives a really good detailed indication of how we got here. And more to the point, where we're going. And like, there were 150 US aircraft involved in this yesterday. This wasn't any sort of small mission, as we have, as we've discussed. I mean, in terms of where we go from here, like, again, they're talking about the fact that this could end up with a war that, people in the US don't want and they don't have the stomach for. Does anybody have the stomach for it? You know, you're talking about defense there as well. I think the other interesting part is going to be that, Ireland is going to be running the EU presidency for the last 6 months mm-hmm. of next year. So defence issues, and as you said, all those EU aspects are going to come up, and it's going to end up being a huge topic here for us to discuss. And the other aspect as well that we, you know, I was reading quite a bit over Christmas is people just don't want to travel to the US anymore. Mm. So you're seeing that even in a lot of, coverage over the past couple of days, where to go on your holidays in the next mm-hmm. 12 months. And the US is really not on the agenda. People are a little bit nervous. They're a bit afraid. They see that the economy over there has changed quite a bit, and who knows where it's all going to end up.
There's a texter in with thinking along the same lines as you are. If Europe had any guts, they'd boycott the World Cup, which, as we all know, is to be held in the USA along mm. with kind of Mexico as well. Europe, UN and NATO have all shown Donald Trump is stronger than they are. They are a disgrace. That takes
well, I mean, they're not wrong, you know. And I mean, back to your point earlier, Brida, that all of this looks very strategic. I mean, everything about this second Trump presidency
is strategic
mm-hmm. and is planned and is detailed. I mean, Project 2025, which he disavowed all the way through the election campaign from day one, has been implemented by this administration. Its entire plan was there for everybody to see. There's nothing unstrategic,
unexpected
about this Trump presidency. He's a master of creating and then manipulating chaos. Mm. So it looks incredibly chaotic, but it isn't. You only have to look at what it is that he's managed to achieve. I mean, I've worked for the last number of years, particularly in the refugee resettlement space, and huge advances have been made during the Biden administration to rebuild community-based refugee resettlement mm-hmm. infrastructure in the United States. Like 400,000 people had come in under sponsorship-based programs welcomed by communities in the US. I predicted that if Trump was to win, that would be burnt down on day one. And that's exactly what happened. He shut all of those programs down on day one. He immediately started to implement that plan from day one. There's no lack of strategy, but he is incredibly chaotic. But mm-hmm. we'd be very stupid. And I think we have to be very careful to treat him as a joke. He's no joke. Mm-hmm. He's deadly serious. And it's really clear what his agenda is.
He's gone beyond anything we could have imagined. I mean, yeah. Could you have imagined ICE, like the manner in which you have US armed troops on the streets capturing people, sending them off to prison, some of the most horrific places of incarceration.
There are no checks and balances anymore.
No checks and balances.
The Supreme Court is now completely captured.
Open prisons in Florida in the middle of swamps. Now, a big question happens. What happens if he loses the midterm elections? Mm-hmm. Because he's not going to concede. But we've already seen him. He hadn't. There wasn't a peaceful transition of power when Donald Trump lost the last time. He had January the 6th. So when his power becomes challenged, if that's during the midterms or afterwards, are we on the verge of American troops or American firing at each other in America? Because we've already seen Chicago cops standing against ICE coming into Chicago. I mean, we are going towards something very dark in world politics that we probably couldn't have comprehended.
And we're less than a year into his presidency, of course.
He's
more than 3 years term.
It's not a joke. He should be taken very, very seriously.
A lot depends on the midterms. I mean, if the Democrats somehow manage to have a big victory in the midterms, that then turns Trump into more of a lame duck president. Mm. And provided those elections are respected and provided that there's a lot of to happen in the way that they need to happen. So that's a very real risk. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to suggest it, but I mean, we're at a point where I think you could see the US itself starting to break apart. You know, you could see succession happening. I don't think necessarily in an overt way, but it's already started to happen in some regards where blue states, where democratic states are now starting to cooperate as the federal government withdraws from particular areas. They're starting to band together and cooperate. You could see in particular some of the wealthier blue states beginning to step back more and more from the idea of a federal United States and beginning to resile from that quite a bit. I mean, one of the things that many people, I think, I was fascinated to read this a couple of months ago, that many of the blue states are significant net contributors to the federal exchequer. Mm-hmm. And many red states are, so Republican states, are net beneficiaries. So most of the big contributors to federal tax budgets and to the federal budgets are Democratic states, big Democratic states, and many of the states that benefit are poor Republican states. There's a recipe for real conflict starting to show itself now.
Genuine conflict that weren't only involved kind of economics so involved. This is one of the most heavily armed places in the world. You forget that there's a lot of people with a lot of guns. There's different styles of military there. There's different departments. And I can see a scenario where Donald Trump doesn't win and he tries to keep all the power. And you see Steve Bannon and people like that already talking about these things.
Mm. The question for us in Europe is, how do we as politicians, we as a European Union, respond to that when there is a dearth of strong leadership, you could argue, in the EU, and everybody, even in the response immediately, whether it was Helen McEntee or whether it was Kaya Kallas or whoever, are terrified to say anything against Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems. I think we have to remember Europe was destroyed by war, which is why we have the European Union. It was a peace project. Now, I understand you have to defend peace. Nobody is stepping away from that at all. But, I mean, what we need to do is go back to our collaboration, see economic strength. America's not in a particularly good economic place at the moment outside of it. This is also a place which has huge levels of poverty, potential for disintegration, has China on one end of it, which is also coming up. So I think Europe needs to remember its reason for existing, which was as a peace project, even though it's hard now. I understand that peace needs to be defended, but we're already putting $800 billion into weapons development in the European Union. At the same time that money's going in there, it's being taken from our climate responsibilities, from investments in areas like poverty, which again is not just kind of a woke left-wing thing to say. We saw what happened in Brexit when communities are left behind. They will burn it down in the sense of removing themselves from it. So look, there's a multitude of different challenges that Europe needs to confront all at once. I don't just think Europe should now be in a military posture, because I think that will be the end of Europe.
Breda, I might give the final point to you, and there's been a few texts in along this line. The flip side of all this, and one texter saying Maduro is a dictator who stole every election he participated in and flooded the US with drugs. Another texter saying, why is no one talking about the drugs coming in from Venezuela to the States? I would call this MAGA action, protecting American citizens from drug cartels.
Yeah, and again, with some of the pieces this morning as well, they're talking about, you know, it is on the basis that they're flooding the US with drugs, but actually at the end of the day, it's probably about oil. because Venezuela have some of the largest oil reserves in the world. And some of the potential outcome then from all of this, some of the economists are saying, is that we could end up with a rise in oil prices. So that's going to, you know, a lot of people sort of sitting here in Ireland today are probably going, well, how does this impact on me? Do I really need to get up to speed on what's happening in Venezuela? And the economists are saying yes, because the impact will come in the pocket, essentially, where the price of oil will rise, you know? So look, I think, yeah, like everything, it sort of feels like it's a long way away, but when you start breaking it down, it does have an impact on everything from the EU to the wider European and world economy.
Yeah. I know you said that was going to be your final point of this one, but on that point about drugs, I mean, that's contested. The idea that Venezuela is a significant exporter of drugs or smuggler of drugs into the United States, that's entirely contested.
Right.
That's not at all.
Overblown.
I'm saying it's highly questionable. It's certainly not accepted. It's the narrative that the Trump administration has put out, but there doesn't appear to be the evidence to back it up.
And they said the same about Canada and fentanyl when it came to tariffs.
Yes,
exactly.
So, I mean, well, even some of the claims in the press conference yesterday that he's gone into X city and ended crime in 2 days and all, like, you know, take everything with a pinch of salt, I suppose. Keep your text coming in. 087-1400-106 is the WhatsApp. My panel are staying with me. One final text, Gary, to leave you with to think about over the break. Our politicians need to get their heads around the difference between neutrality and defence. It's shameful how poorly we are defended. You'll be shocked to learn that housing is one of the big stories across the papers yet again for the however many weeks in a row, but some pretty significant figures. Obviously, we've had the homeless figures in the last couple of days, but also Bree did this story on the front page of the Sunday Independent. And this is around the rent reforms that are coming in later this year. And it is set to make what is already a minefield for a lot of people in the Fair Deal scheme, even difficult, is the report.
So these reforms are coming in on the 1st of March, and basically they're designed to give greater protection to tenants who are renting. And they're going to allow tenants to remain in a rented property for 6 years, even if the homeowner wants to sell that property within that time frame. So the issue now is that some people are coming out and saying there will be unintended consequences for homeowners and for landlords. And one of the issues is around and the whole Fair Deal scheme. So families of residents in nursing homes are basically being warned that the new reforms could mean that they will end up not being able to maximise how much they can get for the property. They essentially can sell, it is quite complicated, as I'm trying to simplify it here this morning. So let's say you've got a relative in a nursing home and for the Fair Deal scheme you decide that you want to sell the home, but in the meantime, while somebody's being in the nursing home, you've rented out that particular property. If you sell the property, you're going to have to sell the property with the tenants in situ, which is going to obviously have an impact then on how much you're inheriting, shall we say, from that particular property.
But also who can purchase it? I mean, it's not, you know, if that house in theory is to be made available to housing stock, fine, there's someone in it renting, but a purchaser, that it's kind of, you're helping one group
but
of
not
people
the other. Correct.
At the cost of another almost.
So it means then that some people are going to be, it's going to firstly potentially devalue the cost of the price of the house, because if you're selling with a tenant in situ, you're probably going to end up selling to another landlord more than anything else. But also then, more to the point, that people will be reluctant to rent out these properties while somebody is in a nursing home, because they know they're going to get tied in for 6 years. So what does that mean? That means we have an awful lot of empty properties then sitting around the country at a time when we have a housing crisis. So yeah, it's quite complicated. And this is where, as I said, they're saying that there will be unintended consequences here, and it could be an absolute car crash. So I think we're probably going to have to look at, looking at the politician on the other side of the room here, we're going to have to look,
Gary,
at
what's the solution?
Look at the legislation.
I will
here
make an amendment to the legislation and it will be voted down.
That's how it works.
That's very much how it works. Look, I read the story this morning, it's just incredibly grim, isn't it? The idea that before you start even thinking about the care provision of a parent or whoever, you have to also start thinking about the fact that we may have to weigh that against rental rights. And I should say, rental rights are the norm in most European jurisdictions. I don't think this is an insurmountable problem. I actually do think this can be solved through some form of legislative amendment. If a house is in the Fair Deal scheme, well, then it actually doesn't come under those particular conditions. It doesn't seem massively complicated. It does. This morning's article does seem a way of, I don't know, there's been a lot of pushback against the idea that we're bringing in a renter's rights and more protections for renters. And this morning I was reading that story just going, this absolutely, it should be a consideration, but it is by no means insurmountable. It can be solved through legislation.
But if it's a case then, Gary, that you bring in one change or one loophole, let's say, for one part of the market, well, then you're going to get pressure then from others, from landlords maybe, who say, well, actually, I do want to sell and I do need to sell. Well, or
But just because you're going to get pressure doesn't mean you should give in to it, right? Mm. An exception should be an exception on the basis that it's an exceptional set of circumstances. And I think in the case of nursing homes, it absolutely is. People going into nursing homes, for instance, may not want... Never mind, I mean, this article is based on the idea that the families of people who are going into nursing homes under the care deal might be reluctant to allow the property to be rented out on the basis that if their relative dies in the nursing home, they're then tied in with having to meet the costs of the fair deal scheme, which are paid after the death of the person in care, mm-hmm. and they're not able to realise the property to meet those costs, and therefore their inheritance might be reduced. Actually, for many people going into a nursing home, the one thing that they very often are very concerned about is the idea that their home will not be their own. So if they're going to a nursing home, they might be open to renting their home out for a year or for 2 years. But the idea of renting their home out for 6 years may well feel like I'm saying, well, I'm never going to go back there again, which is a very big thing to ask somebody to do. There'll be huge reluctance on the part of people going into nursing homes to give up their right to live in their own homes for a 6 year period if they think... I mean, it's just very emotive and a really important piece that people need to take into consideration. I do think the Fair Deal scheme is particularly exceptional, and carving out an exception for the Fair Deal scheme under this legislation makes sense. I do think it would be horrendous if it was used as an excuse to get rid of the idea that we would provide some kind of security of tenure for in the rental market, because I think that's an incredibly important security that tenants need. But also, I think it'll start to rebalance our rental market to one that considers the needs and rights of tenants ahead of the profits of very large corporate landlords, and that would be a good thing for our rental market overall. Like, our rental market is insane, for heaven's sake. How have we gotten to a point where it's significantly cheaper to buy a house and pay a mortgage than to rent? Like, significantly, by thousands per month. It's insanity. Yeah. We're at a point of absolute insanity, and we can't keep on going on the way that we're going on. We were talking when we looked at the fact that this was one of the issues that we'd be talking about on the panel today. You know, I had a bit of a moment, oh God, we're talking about housing again. Like, what is there left to say? We're now at a point of 17,000 people homeless. You know, when it was 14,000, there was uproar. It's now 17,000, and it feels a bit like we're all a bit resigned to the idea. Excuse my language now, but that housing is just a shit show here and there's nothing that can be done about it. We have to be really careful that we don't allow ourselves to get into a space where we become resigned to the idea that there are not solutions to the housing catastrophe. It's no longer a crisis. It's a catastrophe in this state, and there needs to be real accountability for that. And by the way, let me say one thing really clearly. One of the things that's really concerned me over the last couple of weeks in particular is efforts on the part of senior politicians to suggest that migration is responsible for a housing crisis. We had a housing crisis in this country long before we had significant levels of inward migration. There's no doubt about the fact that population pressures contribute to the housing crisis, but only because our political system and successive governments have not planned for population growth in a way that supports the development of our economy and sustains our society. That's the problem. The problem is not migration or population growth. The problem is appalling housing policy and housing and implementation and delivery of housing policy, and a failure to deliver and to roll out public services, including housing, in a way that meets the needs of our population.
Yeah. As you said, it's kind of one of those weird ones where it could become what health was seen as, that it's just this insurmountable problem.
It's Angola.
Angola.
But then every political prediction piece that you are reading in the papers today is talking about the fact that housing and infrastructure need to be top of our agenda.
Yeah.
So it does seem to be top of the agenda every single year. We just can't seem to be able to.
But it feels a bit like saying, I should be going to mass. Like, it's the kind of thing that people think they should say, or politicians think they should say.
But they're not taking steps to fix it. And I mean, our house prices, as we said, have gone up 7.3% in the past 12 months. So, I mean, surely there is a way of sitting down and looking at what are the issues here and how do we address
it. I mean, I think they dispute the idea that they're not taking steps to fix it. They're just not fixing it. The steps they're taking aren't working. And the biggest problem is that they seem to be constantly repeating variations of the same measures that have not previously worked. And things are just getting worse. But like, at what point are we going to say, none of what you're doing is working effectively. We need a massively different approach.
But it kind of also comes back to the problem, and there's a piece by Owen O'Brien in the Mail today, and the headline is something along the lines of housing can't be fixed, but not by this government. And Gary, I kind of feel like Owen and Brynn has been saying this for 15 years as well, because the solutions, you guys might be putting them forward, they're not getting listened to, you put them forward again and people sort of just get tired of it.
One of, I mean, we can't get tired of it. We have to believe that the climate
naturally,
change.
I hope, yeah, wouldn't be.
I certainly aren't. One of the things that stood out for me in the last 6 months, we, like Jack Collison wrote the article about how we have such infrastructural deficits and pointed to all these, what he described as climate goals. And then I thought to myself, less than 2 years ago, probably less than 18 months ago, we had the planning bill going through Dáil Éireann. It was the third largest piece of legislation in the history of the state. I remember my colleague Cian O'Callaghan made something like 270 amendments to that bill, each of them voted down. And then within a year, we were told by all in government, everybody who voted through that bill, that we need to look at our planning, our infrastructure is a problem. Yeah. And it's going, well, do you not see how that was actually a failure of to do your job at that point? Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like as an opposition party, we'd done our job with the old Milton Amendments that kind of Callum went through. I just can't. And then Jack Collison wrote an article, and all of a sudden, now we need to look at our infrastructure. It's like, yeah, well, maybe we need to look at like who's leading us, how this has been done. And I do fundamentally have come to the belief that actually, I look across the chamber and I don't see anybody over there who I wouldn't think I'd do a better job at. If that's cracking heads, if it's actually even developing legislation so we can have infrastructure in a way that previous developments would have been done, rather than just hoping that things work out in the end, which is how successive governments have done it for the last 10, 15 years. So yeah, I don't disagree that actually a change of culture, a change of approach, a change of people at the top may actually bring us to some different ends.
And then if you look at, you know, if you look at what's happened with the Metrolink there just before Christmas, where we were in the process of having a legal challenge against it, they came to an agreement where they were going to the residents came to an agreement where they would sell their houses to Infrastructure Ireland. No price tag has been put on that as yet, but there is a piece in the Business Post today where a house on Dartmouth Square has just sold for 2.8 million, just under 3 million essentially. So they're saying this is an indication of the price of those homes that the government is now going to buy to make sure that that Metrolink happens. There's about 10 homes going to be involved. Multiply that by about 3 million. Mm-hmm. What's that? That's 30 million. So suddenly they can throw 30 million at an infrastructural problem to get rid of an obstacle to make sure that Metrolink happens. And that all happened quite quickly. So if we can do that in the space of a couple of weeks before Christmas, why can't we do that on an ongoing basis?
Yeah.
And figure it out.
In fairness, probably the only thing that's happened quickly on the Metrolink project. Gary, just before we go to the break, you were talking about the change of leadership and different in government, and your colleague Jennifer Whitmore is in the Mail on Sunday saying Sock Dems will not ever do a coalition or a deal with Fine Gael. Is that party policy or has she done a solo run here?
No, I read that today. I think that was the headline. I don't think it's actually what Jen said. Jen said that it doesn't seem likely. And that's something that we've always said. Look, I don't think, like, I'm somebody who believes in a republic and a republic people have different views, but I've watched Fine Gael for best part of 6-7 years in the Dáil, and I think it's fair to say I don't think we'd be compatible, but that's not to say that we won't talk to them or anything. We've always prided ourselves since their foundation on we'll talk to everybody afterwards. And look, if I get a national health service, if we get proper infrastructural development, proper homes built, it doesn't really matter to me who does that, but I don't believe we'd find common ground with Fine Gael, and I think that's what Gemma's trying to convey today.
Because the view in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil would be the Sock Dems aren't really serious. Did you say that you'll talk, but really you have these red lines and that you wouldn't go in with anyone anyway?
I sat across from Micheál Martin after the last general election when it came down to kind of negotiating for government. He'd already done the deal with the independents before we sat in a room for him. He hadn't even read our manifesto by the time we sat down. If there was one person who wasn't serious about being in government with a particular entity at the table that day, it was Micheál Martin. So that is a way of undermining, I appreciate it, but I didn't get involved in politics to not have a pen in my hand and developing legislation. That's all we're here for.
We're looking at the Ireland Thinks poll in the Sunday Independent, and what's different about this one is that they have got famous faces to ask specific questions that they've then put to their research team and had people answer the questions. Everyone from Michael O'Leary to John Boyne, Terry Prone, Luke O'Neill, Vincent Brown, they've all asked different questions in different parts of society. Breida, any one in particular catch your eye?
Yeah, so just following on from the conversation we were having about sort of infrastructure, Dermot Bannon asked the question, would you choose to live in a city? And the results actually surprised me. 65% said no, they would prefer not to live in a city. So only 35% would prefer to live in the city. And he goes on then to say, you know, what is the reason for this? Why wouldn't people want to live in a city? Because it is supposed to be, you know, full of culture. It's the lifeblood of everything that we do. But I think part of the issue is a lot of our cities have become sort of quite run down and not the best places to be, certainly since COVID. We have an issue with antisocial behaviour, obviously, in our capital city and some of the other cities around the world. So I think there's topics there that we need to look at in terms of the wider infrastructure side of things, but also how we get our cities back on track. And it, one of the things Dermot Bannon says as well is that the solution lies in the fact that we've one of the least dense cities in Europe. So we've huge potential to grow and provide housing, green spaces, culture and great workplaces. Again, as we were only talking about earlier on, this is all great, but it's pie in the sky because we've no plans and no real strategic plans. He says this requires, of course, requires planning and our system is broken at the moment. And he's absolutely right. But he says we have to push and we have to advocate for better cities. And I couldn't agree with him more.
I presume you're shocked at these 65%, Gary, as a city boy yourself.
Shocked at them all. Maybe the question, maybe when people think about living in a city, they think about the cost of rent. They think about
They think about because it's prohibitive.
That's exactly it. I think when the idea of living in a city is somewhere where you can afford to live. I mean, we have doctors, nurses, guards who work in hospitals around Dublin who can't afford to live around Dublin because, I mean, to live in a city in people's minds now is to go without. I mean, that might be to go without meals, it might be to go without any access to a night out culture. So I think that has probably impacted that poll. That's what I'm choosing to believe anyway.
But it might also reflect the fact that a significant percentage of the population doesn't actually live in a city and is quite happy enough to do so.
As somebody
who lives in a rural, outside a small rural town like in North Wexford, it's commuter belt, but it's rural. I mean, I literally live in the middle of agricultural farmland and love it. And we moved back here from London. I made a choice to live there.
Yeah.
And because that's where we wanted to raise our kids. It's an interesting stat, but actually, an awful lot of people don't live in cities.
Travelled up from rural Wexford, where your in-laws are from. you can push me out as a secret. And I love being down there. I absolutely love going down. But after about 3 days, I start to get like, why is it so dark?
So you can go out and look at the stars, Gary. That's why it's so dark.
Smell of fresh air.
Yeah. It's interesting that the question was, why would you choose to live in a city? I mean, what about towns as well? We've so many big towns around the country. And again, one thing I noticed as well over the Christmas period, just moving around a little bit, just how run down a huge amount of our towns have become. Like, there is an argument for just revamping the main street of a lot of our towns and pumping a little bit of money from the local councils into just trying and just, you know, they just looked derelict, some of them. And also this living above the shop scenario probably needs to come back. We just need more energy back in the town so that they are a place we want to be.
Just as an aside on all of this, I mean, I've seen it in some of the towns where I live. I live in North County Wexford, almost on the Wicklow border. So Gorey is my nearest town, but I also went to Arklow quite a lot. Arklow is a case in point of a town where I've seen Arklow was very derelict, was really in decline. Like, the main street was pretty awful. It wasn't going anywhere at all. Since the lockdowns and since remote working started, you can see now more and more small businesses opening up in towns like Arklow. There's a kind of a revitalization that's happened now. Like, there's some fantastic little cafes and stuff. If you're ever down in Arklow, make sure you go to a place called a local grocer, which is an amazing little cafe in Arklow that nobody quite believes is there. It's a really good example of some of the vibrancies that we've seen coming in since remote working started to happen for people. That's really changed the way that we think about where we live and how we will work, and I think it's something that we need to continue to support.
Yeah. You picked out another interesting one, Colm.
Yeah, Catriona O'Sullivan, she's the author of that excellent book, Poor. She's also a psychologist. She asked, her question was, how much do you think hard work alone determines success in Ireland today? And she was saying that when she asked the question, you know, it was on the, she quite cynically thought that people say, no, hard work counts for everything, because we're told work hard and everything will be okay. And it's not necessarily what she believed. And actually what came back was that only 6% of people believe that hard work almost entirely determines success in Ireland. 29% believed mostly, and 34% believed about half. So hard work is about half of what contributes to success in Ireland. She was very encouraged by that. She said she was really heartened by that because it reflected her own view that hard work matters. She wouldn't be where she is without extraordinary effort. But she goes on to say, but effort alone did not open doors for me. People did. Effort alone did not ensure policies existed that allowed me to access free education, childcare, and an alternative route into university that did not rely on leaving cert points. People, policies, and practices, plus my extraordinary level of hard work, made success possible. Structures did something. Second chances did something, and sheer luck did something.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really, really important point. And before we get too complacent about things, I think we should still recognise that we still live in a supposed republic, or in a republic, where people's experience of education, including primary education, which is meant to be free, is dependent upon the ability or capacity of their families to pay for that experience. Mm. Whether it's through what are often seen as extracurricular elements of education, whether it's through the contribution that can make to their school, etc. You know, we don't have an equal playing field in this country yet. So hard work alone doesn't help people achieve whatever we're told. So actually, I think it's quite encouraging mm-hmm. and demonstrates quite a level of a mature society that understands that. But now we have to make sure that we defend the systems and structures that are required and advance those to make sure that success is achievable for anybody who's prepared to put in the work, but that actually people have the procedures, the approaches, the policies, the services, the supports to be able to work hard within and then
support. Yeah, I would have, when I read that at first, I would have said I would have been in the almost entirely and mostly, and then when I had a thought about it, I thought how many bits of luck I've had along the way, or what if I hadn't got the Susie Grant, wouldn't be here at all.
That isn't what they say, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
That's it. And our guest in the next hour, Sinead O'Sullivan, is going to be arguing the opposite point, because her opening chapter is how if you work hard enough, you can be anything. So we'll totally flip that on its head. We're out of time for our panel, unfortunately. Breida Brown of Unique Media, Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner and founder, former director of 1 in 4, and Gary Gannon of the Social Democrats. Thanks so much for joining me, and Happy New Year to you.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.